Hello, this is your Polycast for Monday, June 27th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, the nurses' strike ends, but the underlying dispute is not resolved. The Minnesota Nurses Association and top officials at Allina Health say they hope to get back to the bargaining table as soon as possible. 4,800 Twin Cities nurses returned to work yesterday after a week-long strike at four Allina hospitals and the Phillips Eye Institute. But as Matt Sepik reports, the nurses' union and hospital management each say they're no closer to a deal on a health plan than they were when the strike began.
The nurses walked off the job June 19th after negotiators for their union and Allina could not reach a deal. Union leaders planned the strike to last just 7 days. It was never meant to be open-ended. At Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis, union nurses showed up for work at 7 a.m. sharp yesterday. Clad in navy blue scrubs, they filed into the building after their non-union replacements clocked out and left through a separate door. Abbott nurse Angela Bichetti is part of her union's bargaining committee. While the strike did not result in a new contract, Bichetti says it strengthened the resolve of the rank and file.
We became more of a family now. We're more united and ready to get on with this. And we don't have a negotiation day set, but we did send that message to Allina.
The main sticking point remains the nurses' health plan. They want to keep the insurance plan they have through the union. To cut costs, the company wants them to switch to a corporate plan 30,000 other employees use called Allina First. The union insurance has higher monthly premiums than the company's, but nurses fear their out-of-pocket expenses will skyrocket under Allina First. Despite the impasse, Bichetti says she is eager to get back to the bargaining table. That's at least one thing she and Allina CEO Dr. Penny Wheeler agree on. Wheeler says the transition to and from the replacement nurses went well and no patients were at risk. But Wheeler says the strike was an expensive distraction that accomplished nothing.
I don't think a strike helps anybody, frankly. I don't know that it helps our patients. I don't know that it helps our communities. I don't know that it helps the nurses who would long to be at the bedside. And I think it's a disruption organizationally. Did it move the negotiation strategy along? I firmly, quite honestly, don't believe so.
Wheeler says the more than 1,300 replacement nurses hired through agencies were paid at a premium, and the company had to cover the travel costs for those from out of town. She didn't say what the final tab was, but the Minnesota Nurses Association pegs it at around $25 million. Throughout the strike, Wheeler has pointed out that union nurses at three of the company's other hospitals in Hastings, Faribault, and Plymouth already have the Allina First plan. Ross Azevedo is professor emeritus of industrial relations at the University of Minnesota's Carlson Business School. He says the union's acceptance of the company health insurance at those hospitals is a definite disadvantage for the nurses in negotiations.
One of the things you always look to in bargaining is what are the comparables? And here's a comparable where the other nurses' unions have accepted this position of the company. And so that weakens the nurse's position. There's no question about that.
Azevedo says until there's a final agreement, it's impossible to tell whether the union's strategy of holding a 7-day strike with a clear end date was a success. Meanwhile, nurses at Abbott Northwestern, United Mercy, and Unity Hospitals and the Phillips Eye Institute will continue to work without a contract. Nurse negotiator Angela Bichetti says another strike, quote, could potentially happen, end quote, but she says that's something the rank and file would have to decide in a vote. Bichetti and Allina's Dr. Penny Wheeler each say they're hopeful a federal mediator will call them back to the table in the coming days. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Some Minnesota farmers have had some tough weather to cope with this year as they tried to get a crop in the ground, but overall most farm fields are in good condition. On the other hand, the economics of the ag sector are not good. While Minnesota's corn crop is worth more than $4 billion, most farmers will struggle to make money on the grain for the third straight year. Mark Stile has the story.
Crop progress on the Richard Peterson farm near Mountain Lake in southwest Minnesota so far this year has been mixed. He has a cornfield that's looking really good.
I suppose it's knee-high or better.
That's a couple of weeks ahead of the old knee-high by the 4th of July standard. But other crops are suffering.
Standing here by a field right now that's underwater.
Ducks swim in a roughly 20-acre pond that's formed on land which should be growing soybeans. Shorebirds dart along the water's edge. It's not been the type of spring Peterson wanted.
wet. No, we've had over 20 inches of rain, I'm sure.
That's about three times what normally falls during the spring. It's been so wet that Peterson still has some soybeans to plant. His experience is common across the southern half of Minnesota. Torrential rains have plagued parts of the region, delaying field work or drowning out crops, or both. There's also been plant-killing hail and even some scattered damage from a frost in May. Then there are areas of the state where farmers have the opposite problem. The skies have been too quiet.
Everybody's got a lot of faith, but every day that goes by without rain, there's a lot of concern.
Kurt Peterson manages the farmer's elevator in the town of Bellingham. Much of west-central Minnesota is abnormally dry, and there's even drought conditions along the border with South Dakota. Peterson says some days the temperature has been close to 100 degrees.
It's that windy, hot weather that's really hard on that corn.
The uncertain weather is causing problems for the affected farmers, but they're in the minority. More fields are thriving than struggling. In fact, the U.S. Agriculture Department says more than 75% of the state's corn, soybean, and sugar beet crops are in good to excellent condition. Spring wheat is slightly lower, rated a still good 64%. Wells Fargo agricultural economist Michael Swanson says that pretty much matches what he's seen.
Minnesota's looking really good. I don't know if we can replicate last year's monster crop yield, but certainly everybody should expect at average or above average right now, given the condition.
But overshadowing this year's good start are continued low grain prices. Crops all across the Midwest are mostly healthy. Grain traders expect another big harvest, and that ample supply is keeping prices down. Right now, corn brings about $3.40 a bushel. Swanson says most farmers need more than that to make money. He says the best news so far this year is that some crop input costs have declined a little.
The big three, cash rents, seed, and fertilizer, have all kind of come back to adjust for the lower prices.
He says the outlook for grain prices is grim as far as the eye can see. A drought or other weather disruption might boost prices, but he says such a jump probably would be temporary. World supply is growing as farmers all over the globe increase their productivity. And those healthy supplies will likely mean continued low grain prices and financial stress for state producers. Southwest Minnesota farmer Richard Peterson says he has fairly low debt, so he expects to withstand the price downturn. But he says farmers with higher debt loads are feeling the pressure.
There's people that's going to be stressed, there's no doubt about that. But hopefully everybody will make it through and can survive it.
The question is how many more break-even or money-losing years the sector can sustain. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, near Mountain Lake.
More than a dozen Minnesota companies, including big names like Best Buy and General Mills, have signed on to an effort aimed at taking sustainability to a new level. The companies want to move away from an economic model that relies on precious and limited natural resources to produce more and more stuff. Elizabeth Dunbar has the story.
Imagine yourself in a native prairie. Birds and insects feed on plants. When they die, they decompose and nourish the soil. The prairie life cycle forms a circle where waste from one species is used by another, year after year. Now take a walk on a busy city street. Cars and trucks spit out pollution from their tailpipes. Disposable cups, plastic bags, and the occasional broken umbrella fill up garbage cans. In the distance, a coal-fired power plant spews carbon pollution while sending out electrons to keep the economy humming.
Most of the Industrial Revolution, we have essentially extracted raw materials, used them, sold what we can, and just got rid of what we couldn't sell.
Raj Rajan is the technical lead for sustainability efforts at Ecolab, one of the companies involved in the new Minnesota Sustainable Growth Coalition. He says the idea behind the coalition is to identify solutions that no individual company could pursue on its own.
It's quite exciting because we are seeing a lot of opportunities to actually move the needle as opposed to do one-off things that might look good on paper but are really not having as much of an impact.
Besides Ecolab, the coalition includes some of Minnesota's biggest names: 3M, Best Buy, Cargill, General Mills, Medtronic, and Target. Several nonprofits, government agencies, and a University of Minnesota institute are also involved. They're looking to embrace a concept called the circular economy, which is inspired by nature. Dave Rappaport is vice president of Earth and Community Care for Aveda, which is part of the coalition. For his company, it means using natural ingredients and renewable energy to create products that are packaged in materials that have been and will continue to be recycled over and over again. Some years ago, Aveda discovered there wasn't enough recycled material available to package its products. So it started a campaign with schools to collect caps made of the high-quality recyclable plastic it needed.
What we're striving for here is behaving like nature does, where there's no such thing as waste.
The circular economy concept isn't new. It's taken off in Europe, and many companies in the U.S. are warming to the idea. Climate change and a growing world population are driving the change in thinking.
The systems as we have evolved them over time, I would say 150 years of industrialization, are no longer cutting it.
Helga Van Turnet of the global consulting firm McKinsey & Company says efforts to transition to a circular economy are only getting started, but she says interest is growing fast. Van Turnet says companies that have already adopted some circular economy business models include Philips, which makes medical devices, lighting, and a variety of consumer goods. She says the company's program that refurbishes medical devices is better for the environment, the company, and its customers.
You are providing access to top-notch healthcare equipment at a fraction of the price. How can you not be excited about that?
She says another important piece of a circular economy is redesigning products so they last longer or can be fixed easily.
That's where you can now say, hey, if I would move that screw over 1 centimeter to the left, instead of messing around for a minute to open up that part of the equipment, now it's going to take me 10 seconds because I can actually access it. That's terrific.
The Minnesota Sustainable Growth Coalition plans to initially focus on three areas: energy, water, and organic recycling. Reporting on the environment, Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Monday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.